Traditionally, what happens is we say, oh, you know, the founders of America, Washington, Jefferson, those people. And we have a very particular framework for who the founders were. They were the people who were proposers of the new government, who wanted the nation to be unified, reflecting the ideology of the Declaration of Independence. And it's a very particular understanding of the framers and who they were. What I want to propose is that perhaps that understanding of the framers and the founders is incomplete. By not examining the Anti-Federalists, or at least not engaging with their ideology, we only get half of the picture of the framing of America. And there's more there to be discovered. In fact, often we think of the Anti-Federalists as the losers. But that would be inaccurate. A lot of Anti-Federalist ideology has actually permeated the political society that we all have inherited. So hopefully with this lecture, I will, if nothing else, spark your interest in what did the Anti-Federalists have to say and how did they say it. But before we get into that, I titled this lecture, Let's Get Ready to Rumble, mostly for my own pure enjoyment of looking up clips on YouTube of WWF, now WWE, Let's Get Ready to Rumble announcements. So, because I am the tutor and I can, I'm going to play a clip of that. You can deal with it. It has nothing to do with academics, but it's fun for me. Let's see if I can get this to go. Just kidding. I can't get the sound to play through there. I did want this to be bigger, though. Oh, even better. Oh, that makes sense.
There you go. Tonight, we are going to witness the most anticipated match in the...
Oh, you're killing me, Smalls! We'll wait for it to load. It was all loaded and everything. If anybody of you watched WWF? Oh, yeah? It's good stuff. As he speaks, I'm going to give you commentary on why this clip is totally relevant to this topic.
Tonight, we are going to witness the most anticipated match in the history of professional wrestling.
Or of government founding.
Championship of the world.
Or the Constitutional Convention.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Wrestling fans.
Or you?
Watching around the world, from the capital city of the United States of America, Washington, D.C.
Yay, America!
Let's get ready to rumble!
Oh, that was just so funny to me. That's it. Like the shortest clip ever. Oh, it's the fever talking. But really, Let's Get Ready to Rumble is relevant because we perceive of the founding as being a bipartisan debate about the benefits of government, the purposes of government, and the role of government in the lives of the individuals. Surprisingly, if you begin to look into the Anti-Federalist ideology, we realize that they understood government in a similar way as the Federalist. They saw the purpose of government as securing the liberty and welfare of the people. This was something that was consistent between the two groups. In fact, the Federalist or the Federalist Papers might be perceived as an apologetic of sorts for the formation of the new Constitution. So one of the critiques of the Anti-Federalists is that they are not cohesive, or you can't just buy a volume of the Anti-Federalist. Well, that critique is only relevant if you perceive of the debate as two camps. Instead, it's a much more complex discussion in which the Anti-Federalists reflect much more of the prevailing views, that the systems of government that were in place, that were preserving of the rights of the individuals, that preserve the rights of the states against centralized unified government, were in fact the norm. And it was the Federalists who needed to convince everybody that this project that they were undertaking was actually worth it. Do not look at me. I'm going to spit out my gum now. Don't look at me! Okay, look at me. I don't care. Anyways. In case you were wondering, that's where I keep my gum. So if we think about anti-federalist ideology, we can see that this is the only thing that's going to be up there, so you can look at it or not look at it. I didn't actually make a PowerPoint for this lecture. It's been a long week, and it's Tuesday. If we think about the way that the dialogue about the discussion that has happened between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists is we see it framed in terms of federalism. Now, federalism typically means the relationship of states to the federal government, and the Federalists were actually in favor of a strong central national federal government. The Anti-Federalists, who perceived themselves as being improperly labeled, in fact, one of the Anti-Federalists said, we shouldn't be called Federalists and Anti-Federalists, we should be called Rats and Anti-Rats. They perceived this label as being a little bit negative. They saw themselves more as defenders of a Republican ideal, or defenders of the state's rights, or defenders of the individual. So even as we begin to engage with this discussion, reconceiving of the labels that the parties have received, and questioning whether or not those labels are accurate. Whether they're accurate or not, they are the labels that we have inherited, and it's important to understand the appropriate framework for that. So one, understanding that the Anti-Federalists actually were not crazy people on the side that nobody cares about because they're losers, but instead were major framers of the constitutional discussion and major framers of the government that we inherited. Well, there's going to be a burp on the tape. And then also realizing that a lot of our understanding of the Constitution and our frame of government comes from an understanding of the Federalist Papers that may be too simplistic. It may be that simply looking at the Federalist Papers is too simplistic a way to perceive of the founding of our nation. If nothing else, the Anti-Federalists were partners in the founding of the nation. Thinking of them as politically cautious and socially traditional is a much more appropriate way of approaching their writings, as varied as they are. All right, so let's talk a little bit about the history. After the Revolution, or even during the Revolution, we see the Declaration of Independence written and presented. If nothing else, it presents a list of legal grievances that the people of the colonies have against the British homeland, but it also sets forth some essential values that the people see. After the Second Continental Congress, we see that the various colonies institute themselves as states, many of which establish written constitutions. Those written constitutions, in many ways, reflect the values of the people within them and highlight a preservation of the rights of the people against the governments that are in place. We also see the institution of the Articles of Confederation. Now, I'm sure that you all in sixth grade history heard that the Articles of Confederation were the system of government that was instituted after the Revolution that allowed the states to work together to fight off Big Bad England. And you may or may not have heard that, oh, the Articles of Confederation really wasn't one country, it was more like a bunch of states. Or you may have heard, the Articles of Confederation was really weak, and it didn't really work, and nobody liked it. Boo, Articles of Confederation. The reality is that the Articles of Confederation served a purpose, and although it was not exactly a strong form of government, it was a form of government. In fact, it was the first form of continental governance that applied to the states themselves. One of the things that it intentionally set out to do was not to preserve the rights of the individual. In fact, the Articles were not concerned with the individual. The Articles of Confederation was concerned with mitigating the interests of the states against each other with limited control of the Congress that was put in place. So its purpose wasn't to preserve the powers of the individuals, but to preserve the powers of the newly founded, newly freed, newly independent states. Unfortunately, things like Shays' Rebellion and other disturbances in the colonies and in the states at the time demonstrated that a weak central government did not help the states in their interactions with each other. So there were internal conflicts between the various interested parties within a state, but the bigger problem was that the Articles of Confederation was insufficient to the task of mediating the relationships of the states themselves. There was also some concern by some of the early framers, particularly George Washington, who perceived the time after the Revolution as being a period in which there was a lack of a cohesive understanding of what it meant to be American. So here they fought this war, they banded together, they retained their particular identity, but we see after the Revolution kind of a loss of a sense of I'm American and introduction of a sense of, oh no, I'm Virginian. In and of itself, this isn't bad, but when looking forward towards the idea of unity, of security, and some of the other values that are emphasized in the Constitution itself, we see that the Articles of Confederation was insufficient to that task. In particular, Madison expressed a concern about majorities within particular states having heavy hands or making the decisions in that state. So some of the framers were particularly concerned that the voices of those whom the Revolution had been fought to preserve, those smaller groups who still were entitled to the unalienable rights identified in the Declaration, were being subjected to the rights of the majority group. So we see some of the beginnings of the kind of conversation that will have to be had later on. So, in light of the Articles of Confederation in light of the Articles of Confederation providing a loose monitoring of the states, a convention is called. The convention is called in May of 1787, known as the Philadelphia Convention, also sometimes known as the Great Convention. It's called actually to amend the Articles of Confederation. So its purpose was not to establish a new form of government, but to look at the existing form of government under the parameters of the Article of Confederation, which was the legal binding document concerning the states and their interactions, and to improve that form. Most of the states, while recognizing that the Articles of Confederation itself were weak, were made up of individuals who valued the power of the states. So the debate was already set, even prior to the proposal of the Constitution, for there to be discussions centering around the rights of the states against the rights of a centralized government. After all, that discussion had already been had in the formation of the Articles of Confederation. So one way to look at the Constitutional Convention is to think of it as a furtherance of the conversation that started in the 1770s, and perhaps a perfection or a moving forward on the idea of how best to operate as colonies occupying the same geographic space post-revolution. What we see then is a group of leaders coming together to reform the government. What happens down the road is that many of the framers realized that the Articles of Confederation couldn't be amended properly because of the limitations within the document. So a proposal was made to scrap the Articles of Confederation and start a new government. This is where we see the Anti-Federalist voice becoming louder. Many of the Anti-Federalists were completely opposed to the idea of creating a new form of government, not because they were anti-government In fact, they were pro-government, just states government. But instead, because they saw the proposal to start a new form of government as a violation of the law that existed. So if the Articles of Confederation are like the speed limit that says drive 55, and there's a convention deciding whether or not the speed limit signs should be white or yellow, what they see happening is, instead of the discussion of whether the signs should be white or yellow, it's let's scrap 55 altogether and make it 65. The problem for the Anti-Federalists, then, was that the founders who were part of the convention were exceeding the scope of the law that was in place. Many of them saw this as problematic. Let me read to you from some of the Anti-Federalists regarding this aspect. This is Elbridge Gerry, Objections, from New York, 18th October, 1797. I actually think that date's wrong. I think it should be 1787. But as the convention was called for the sole and express purpose of revising the Articles of Confederation and reporting to Congress and the several legislators such alterations and provisions as shall render the federal constitution adequate to the exigencies of government and the preservation of the Union, I did not conceive these powers extended to the formation of the plan proposed. But the convention being of a different opinion, I acquiesced in it, and being fully convinced that to preserve the Union, an efficient government was indispensably necessary, and that it would be difficult to make proper amendments to the Articles of Confederation. Here we see Mr. Gerry saying, hey, wait a minute. The whole point of this conversation, the whole point of the convention, the sole and express purpose was revision of the Articles of Confederation. That's what I came here to do. Once we get there, everybody's talking about how this isn't working. They decided that we want to propose a new government. I'm here. I'll go along with the project. Other Anti-Federalists had a much stronger response of it. Some proceeded to describe the convention as a disagreeable alternative of either exceeding the powers delegated to us and giving our assent to measures which we conceive destructive of the political happiness of the United States, of the citizens of the United States, or opposing our opinion to that body of respectable men to whom these citizens had given the most unequivocal proofs of confidence. These quotations, I think, and that was Yates and Lansing in The Reasons of Dissent, Albany, 21st of December, 1787. So the reasons that we see for the debate even beginning was this idea that the delegates of the Constitutional Convention were going beyond the legal scope that was provided for them. Many of the Anti-Federalists also wanted to see the Articles of Confederation preserved because of its deference to the states. So taking into consideration that the independence of the states was what was fought for, in some sense. It wasn't so much that they were dissatisfied. Excuse me. Pardon me. And water. It wasn't so much that, again, they were opposed to government. They were opposed to a government that subjected the rights of the states to that of a strong central or federal government. And that makes sense, right? They'd come from underneath a very strong centralized government in the form of a king. It wasn't a federal government in the way that we perceive of it, but it was a centralized government. So it makes sense that the leaders of the states were resistant to anything that even sniffed and or smelled and or resembled and or blinked and kind of sort of looked like a strong central government. They liked the diffusion of power. One of the ways that we see Anti-Federalist concerns, however, being taken into consideration in the formation of the new government is through the Connecticut Compromise. So during the convention, the Virginia Plan and the New Jersey Plan are put forward. One says that the representation of the people via the state should be based on the number of people in each state. The other says each state gets one representative. They debated this for days. There was an impasse. You think it's hot in here right now with all of us sitting there? They're in stinky Philadelphia having this conversation. Not even a conversation, having these debates. And they can't get past whether or not the representation of the states should be proportional or equal. You have the Anti-Federalists saying, every state is equal. That was one of the tenets that the Articles of Confederation preserved, was each state was represented equally, and every state had to agree for something to act. The proponents of the new Constitution were saying, look how useless this unanimous requirement is. Look how useless it is that we all have the same representational vote. In fact, some of us are bigger and we should have more say. But the impasse between the limits of the state's rights and the manifestation of the state's rights led to a stalemate. Finally, at some point, though, the Connecticut Compromise was presented, which had both a national principle of representation with a representation based on proportional population of the states and state sovereignty element. So even there we see the Anti-Federalists were not the losers. They were the voice of dissent in this debate. They wanted to essentially protect the role of the states in the formation of the new government. If nothing else, the voice of the Anti-Federalists was the voice of right formation of government. Their primary concerns were that the government that was established reflected the will of the people. One of the things that we see is that despite the confusion over whether or not the Constitutional Convention itself was legal, what we have in the Constitutional Convention is one of the first democratic foundings of a nation. So by that I mean the first time that lots of thinking men got together, sat around in a stinky room, swatting flies, arguing over what the best form of government was. Typically, government was instituted by a particular monarch, or it was instituted by a particular faction. Here we have a group of men engaging in heavy debate. In fact, it's Madison in Federalist 37 who indicates the very uniqueness of the founding. This is very clearly a unique event in the history of the world. A government that's going to be established by reflection and choice. Whether we like the choice that came out is another question. So as we dig further into some of the Anti-Federalist concerns, we see that while the very, not very, V-E-R-Y, but the varied, V-A-R-I-D, interests of the Anti-Federalist prevented them from having a cohesive presentation of their thought, there were certain themes that were recurring and that were valuable to people who were basically against a federal form of a unified nation. So if we think of them as those who were against strong, unified, national government, we see certain themes coming out. We're only going to talk about two this evening, mostly because my throat hurts, and I want to get you out of here in time for those of you who are freshmen to finish your paper, and for those of you who have already finished your paper to just go do something else, perhaps play Bloom's Tower Defense. We are specifically going to look at federalism concerns of the Anti-Federalist and republicanism concerns of the Anti-Federalist. The Anti-Federalist thought can also be centralized on ideas of economics, so looking at capitalism and its role in a free society in particular. I'm not going to go into that tonight, although at the end of the lecture I will provide some other sources that you can take a look at to think more broadly about these terms. Specifically, though, we're going to take a look at Anti-Federalist thought on federalism and Anti-Federalist thought on republicanism. Federalism basically is the expression of the core concern of the balance of powers between collective states and a large centralized government. The core concerns of the Anti-Federalists centered around the belief that people are the sovereigns of government, and that there should be an express reservation of the powers of the people or the states. So one, it's the people who are actually in control of the government, the people who provide power to the government. And it's the people through the state who should be in charge of the government or who should be the final recourse of the government. So they were concerned that the new Constitution was inverting that power, that instead of the people being the sovereigns, you would have the federal government, then the states, then the people. So they were concerned that that was going to be inverted. Further, the Anti-Federalists were concerned that there should be an express reservation of powers. So in the Federalist Papers, you see the Federalists saying, while the balance of powers will protect the rights of the people by making sure that no portion of the government gains too much power. And we've said what these people can do, but we don't want to over-limit it. And in fact, the rejection of a limitation of an expression of the rights of the people is what preserves the rights of the people more fully. The anti-federalists were the first to say, hey, wait a minute. Just because you tell me that this balance of powers is going to work this way, it doesn't mean that individuals are going to be protected. We need a list of rights that the government cannot infringe upon. So one of the major lasting political influences of the Anti-Federalists, in fact, is the Bill of Rights that expressly enumerates the rights of the people against the strong federal government. A few states refused to ratify the Constitution without the inclusion of a Bill of Rights, which demonstrates that the Anti-Federalist thought was not simply losing side thought, but actually expressed core concerns of the people at the time. Another way of thinking of anti-federalist thoughts on federalism is to say the anti-federalists were very locally minded. They perceived the role of the state's government as being a preservation of the rights of the people. The leaders of the state governments were locally elected. They saw that as being directly representational of the needs of the individuals, and they were concerned that a strong federal government would be so far removed from the people that it couldn't possibly address their needs and concerns. Or in the inverse, that those people who were elected to the positions in the national government would begin to see their roles and perceive of their power in a much stronger and broader way than was beneficial to the people. So the anti-federalists, if nothing else, were very locally minded. In opposition to that, the Federalists seemed to be much more nationally minded. They were more concerned with national unity. They were more concerned with peace amongst the states. It's not that they weren't concerned with the individuals, but they perceived the strong national government as providing a better mechanism for preserving the rights of the individual. Again, what we see that we inherited is somehow a balance between the two. Another thing that the anti-federalists were wary of in relation to the Federalist-Anti-Federalist debate was a system of government that preferenced the whole to the part. So if you had me for the Federalist Papers, one of the things that we talked about is the role of factions in politics, and we'll talk about that a little bit more with anti-federalist thoughts of republicanism. But their concerns about factions from the anti-federalist perspective was that you went from a government in which the parts were important, right? Each state is valuable in and of itself and equally, to a government in which the whole is valued. So it's no longer what's best for Virginia, but what's best for the United States as a whole. Thinking about the way that the founders had moved forward in the Declaration with the rights of the parts and the rights of the whole being violated by the central entity, we can see why these concerns would be true. If you institute a strong central government, it seems like only a matter of time that the various parts concerns will be overlooked. They saw value in the rights of the whole and the good of the whole being professed, but they were concerned that, once again, state rights would be unduly diminished and that individual rights would not be adequately protected. So remember when I said after the Declaration of Independence and the Articles of Confederation, we have many individual states' constitutions that include their own Bill of Rights. The concern that the Anti-Federalists had was that this new form of government would, in fact, critiques of the Anti-Federalists was that, oh no, they're all about abolishing government at all and they only want individual states, or they think this is just going to become one big lump pie of government. If you look at Anti-Federalist thought, you see that their arguments are a little bit more nuanced than we don't like the idea of big government running our lives. They had legitimate concerns that instead of being sovereign states, sovereign and independent states, they would now be one big state, or the needs of the states would simply be subject to the strong centralized government. So again, it's a little bit more nuanced than our critiques tend to give the Anti-Federalists credit for. As I said earlier, the strengthening of a centralized government for them necessitated the destruction of state sovereignty and traditional republicans. Republicanism, not Republicans. One of the things that they valued about the Articles of Confederation was its emphasis on state sovereignty. And they appreciated the fact that the Articles of Confederation was specifically geared towards a federation of states. So under the new government, we see the emphasis on a union of the people. Under the Articles of Confederation, we see the union of the states. If we adopt a government that emphasizes the people broadly, we lose the value of the states. There also were geographical interests. I mentioned earlier that there was concern that the needs of the Virginia would be subjected to the needs of the whole. But practically, think about this time. So nowadays, you can hop in your spiffy car. Maybe you have a Passat. Maybe you have a Beamer. Maybe you have a Slug Bug. Maybe you have a piece of crap that just goes. I don't know. I don't know what your parents got you. But nowadays, we can drive between states or we can fly between states. The transition between one locality and jurisdiction is not as complex or technical as it used to be. Back in the day, if you wanted to go from Virginia to North Carolina, for example, you got on a horse and or got in a wagon and or got in some kind of covered carriage kind of thing that did not have air conditioning. You could not have your iPod playing and or the radio. But instead, you probably sat across from some farting old lady and had to ride all the way down. Again, sticky hot, not really manageable. Communication isn't as easy. So the idea that they wanted to create a government that spanned such a broad geographical swath seemed ludicrous to them. It was the idea to them, probably much more akin to our thinking of if we unified the United States and England and Morocco and, I don't know, pick something. Hawaii's part of the United States, so that doesn't work. Australia. But the idea of how difficult it is or how much time it takes to travel from one of those countries to the other, that's what the Anti-Federalists were thinking about this new government. It wasn't so much that, once again, they were being selfish about their land or any of the more simplistic critiques we have of the Anti-Federalists, but they were genuinely concerned that this government was just going to be too big, that it was unwieldy. Which leads us to our last section, which is Anti-Federalist thoughts about republicanism. In particular, this idea of republicanism that the Anti-Federalist put forward reflects the values of Montesquieu, who was a French writer, I believe. I'm going to say French because Montesquieu sounds French. Thank you, Mr. Shelton. A French writer who advocated republics that relied on virtue for their sustenance. Republics in particular that were free governments of popularly elected individuals. But the highlighting element of the republics that Montesquieu advocated were small territories with a homogeneity of interests, which was very different than the territory and the interest proposed to be addressed by the quote-unquote new republican form of national government. In fact, if we were sitting in a debate right now with the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists might burst out laughing and say, "You silly Federalist, you think you can have a republican form of government over such broad swath of land? Ha, 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 we are the true Federalists. We understand that government can only be instituted in small groups of like-minded people. You silly Federalist." The Anti-Federalists genuinely perceived this proposal of a government spanning such a large group of land and such varied interests as being ridiculous. In fact, it was the Anti-Federalists who felt that government should pay attention to religions and good morals because that was the only element that facilitated the kind of virtuous leaders that were needed for true republican form of government. I think what's an interesting fact is that many of the states had establishment of religion provided for in their constitutions. So one of the values that we recognize today is that government can't force religion on us, but many of the states had a state religion. Many of the states had religious tests for the legislatures and the representatives of the people in the states. So even the exclusion of religion from the Constitution or from the proposed form of government to them was both ridiculous and was a faulty idea. Going back to the idea of factions, in Federalist Number 10, water. In Federalist Number 10, the writers of the Federalist Papers advocate, or at least acknowledge, that factions are part of political life. Because people have liberty, they are likely to occlude based on their interest and their abilities to pursue those interests, and because of that, there will be factions. So instead of trying to control the existence of faction or control the causes of faction, government should be involved in controlling the effects of faction. The anti-federalists believed that factions were detrimental, and so they wanted to advocate a form of government that eliminated factions. The way that they saw doing that was to limit the size and space of people being represented so that the small amount of people all had the same ideas about what was valuable. Then the representatives could present those same ideas at the next level of government. They wanted to... What did I write here? Oh. Their primary critique was that the new form of government, instead of controlling the effect of factions, actually provided for factions and encouraged factions. And that they saw as being problematic. They believed that the liberties of the individual and the liberties of the whole were actually negatively affected by the presence of factions. And so they had a problem with the inclusion or the provision for that kind of representational debate. They wanted to see a system of government that created no place for faction and provided for equal representation of similar ideologies, as opposed to equal representation of disparate ideologies with a provision for something that perceives the good of the whole. Only because the needs of the whole were so varied and could be so disparate from the needs of the few. Other concerns that the Federalists had in relation to republicanism, and probably wrapping up now, is that fundamentally, they saw the new government as not only providing a dangerously strong central leader, or a dangerously strong central power, but essentially setting up a government that would allow for an aristocracy, which for them was like blaring, flashing red lights. Oh no, we don't want this. We just came out from underneath a system in which aristocracy ruled. They believed in the powers of the great middling class, which is different than the great middle class, which is how we tend to think of classes today. Middling was more of a reference to kind of the average individual within the states, the farmer. So, in fact, one of the anti-federalist writers' pseudonym was Federal Farmer. They believed that this new form of government would eliminate the voice of the average middling individual, but instead would put forth simply the voice of the aristocracy that was going to be leading this country. And they had a concern with that. They didn't want to be part of a society in which the privileged few, whether that be educationally privileged or financially privileged, led and dictated the society. Instead, they wanted to be part of a system in which representatives were chosen from that great middling class. Those representatives were rotated often and quickly so that they couldn't get too much a sense of their own power, and that they wanted to avoid what could be perceived as despotic rule of the few. So remember that they wanted to avoid faction, but they saw this government as not only increasing faction, but giving power to particular factions that were privileged in some way. Finally, and one of the arguments that I think is very practical, and may be reflected in some of the ways that we perceive of government today, was that the Anti-Federalists were really concerned with a lack of civic participation. At least under a states' rights kind of system, they argued, or at least a system in which the power of government was concentrated in the states, the great middling class was required to participate because of the rapid rotation, because of the representational issues, because of the homogeneity of interest, because of the small territory being covered. If you instituted a strong national central government, there would be a tendency of the people to step away from civic participation and to adopt an attitude that the representatives had it. I wonder how much that concern of the Anti-Federalists is manifested today when we think of the breadth of our nation, just how disconnected we often feel from the kind of government that happens at the federal level, and even how disconnected we feel from the government that happens at the state level. Who can name all of the legislative representatives in the California legislature? I can't. I don't even care. If I'm being honest, I don't even care. But the Anti-Federalist concern was very much towards that apathy. If we create a strong central government, the people for whom independence and liberty was sought will no longer be concerned about the government. And if the sovereignty of the government, or if the powers of the government come from the sovereignty of the people, oughtn't we have a people who care about civic participation? So those are some of the anti-federalist thoughts on the founding of the new government. Like I said, this is an area that I think is really interesting. It's an area that we don't get to talk about much in Tory, but is relevant to our formation of the ideas of government. Yes, the Constitution was accepted, but the Constitution was a formed document from lots of debate, and some of the debates that are put forth in Anti-Federalist ideology are important, and you owe the Bill of Rights to the Federalists. So every time you say, it's my First Amendment right, or I can have this gun because the Second Amendment says so, whatever, you owe the Anti-Federalist. Before I give any quick resources, are there any questions? Is that a question, Mr. Drebinger? Well, quit making it look like it's a question, Mr. Drebinger. Gosh! Yes, ma'am.
Since the Anti-Federalists had a legitimate concern and they actually contributed to the way that we govern, why are they always made out to look like the bad guys?
Part of it is because of, so one is we like to talk about winners, and the Federalists took the time to put all of their ideas, if nothing else, in a unified format. It was presented systematically. Part of their goal was the imposition of the rule of reason in our form of government, and a restriction on an impassioned perception of government. So one of the things you see in particular in the Federalist Papers is kind of this language of emotion and passion when describing arguments against the Constitution, but then this language of, oh, it's reasonable, and it's cool, and it's, they actually say cool. It's reasonable to want to accept this form of government. So the debate is already skewed as, if you're for the federal government, you're cool and rational. And if you're against the federal government, oh, you're just one of those silly, religious, impassioned people. So even at the beginning of the discussion, or as a aspect of a continuance of the debate after the Constitution is proposed, is this dichotomy of values. Do we want to be a nation that's led by impassioned, emotive, religious fools, or do we want to be a nation under a government that's established by reason and cool intellectual debate? The reality is that we value both, and we see the reflection of the value of both in the final product and in the form of government that we have. But I think the characterization of the debate as one of reason against the emotions helped to facilitate subjugating anti-federalist thought. You see a reemergence in the academy of looking at anti-federalist thought. One of the primary academic writers about anti-federalist thought was Cecilia Kenyon. She wrote way back in the day. But a lot of her thoughts are actually still debated and still utilized to characterize the anti-federalists. And she was one of the first to say, hey, wait a minute. Here is a group of people, albeit somewhat disparate, who have concerted valuable opinions about the form of government, and in fact whose valued and dissenting opinions have contributed to the form of government that we now have. So she perceived of the situation as being inappropriately skewed toward the Federalists, and saying, wait a second, if we only think of this new government as a Federalist government, we're missing out on the whole debate that was in fact the unique aspect of our founding. What's unique about our government is the fact that it was formed in the midst of intellectual and often impassioned debate. And by impassioned, I mean those guys were crazy. Like, they would yell, they would fight, they would throw sticks at each other. Like, it was just craziness. Total tangent. But I don't care. If you go onto YouTube and Google, like, congressional fights or government battles, you can see, like, a series of clips of different legislative bodies in different countries. And there's this one where... Wait a second. There's this one where some representative of some country is clearly giving a very impassioned explanation for why whatever bill they're voting on or whatever they do in their country is valuable. And some representative comes up from out of the expansive mix of representatives and slaps the snot out of this person. It's just like, boom! And it's so funny. It has nothing to do with anything. But I think part of why we see the Federalist ideology being elevated and anti-Federalist ideology being subjugated is because of that reason versus emotion kind of rhetorical language. It was effective from a persuasive perspective, but it may have led us to discredit something that's valuable in the debate. Other questions, thoughts, questions, comments?
Government is described best as a constitutional, federal, democratic republic in that particular order. In the context of this discussion, is that accurate or not?
Accurate from the perspective of the anti-federalists, or just generally accurate?
Is it accurate in the context of this historical discussion?
Mm-hmm.
The discussion is usually skewed towards the federalists.
Yeah, I think, I don't know that the order is necessary for its accuracy, but all four of those words are involved, right? So if you think of the values that are being put forth, is everybody seems to think having a constitution and being constitutional is a good idea. You've seen that put forward from the states when they're in power by themselves, and it's going to be a value in this discussion. Federal in the sense of states versus centralized government, or federal in the sense of, in the new way that the Federalists are using it, with an emphasis on the central government. So that word's got to stay in. Democratic insofar as it's representational to some extent. I don't know that I would put democratic before republican in this particular context, at least from the perspective of the anti-federalists. They would value republicanism over democracy. Democracy being more facilitating more of the factious dialogue. So if everybody gets to say what they think in that moment, there's not going to be homogeneity. Instead, there's going to be a lot of disruptions and factions. So they would say, no, we need to clump together about what we agree on and then represent somebody to represent us because we all agree on this anyway. So they probably would invert republicanism and democracy. They might even boot democracy out of the picture altogether as far as their value. I think the system that we end up with has all four. I think it depends on who you ask as to which the order is. So I don't know if that's helpful. Yeah. Other questions? Thoughts, questions? Questions, thoughts, comments?
What's the major reason for the shift between associating ourselves with the state government and more associating ourselves with the federal government? So, for example, during the American Civil War, some people seceded from the Union because their states seceded from the Union.
Mm-hmm.
But now most of us associate ourselves more with the federal government, and to us that would be completely ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So what's the major catalyst for that change of loyalties or associations?
Couple of things. Some people would say there hasn't been a shift. You're just buying Federalist propaganda, right? They'll say, well, you only think that because you've bought whatever the Federalists are selling to you. I think that might be a little bit uncharitable. I think the size of our country has facilitated that. At one point, states were a much smaller entity, and so it was much easier to perceive of yourself. First and foremost, as a Virginian. But now, if you think about it, California is ginormous, right? So even the concerns about size that were being addressed at the time, in some ways, no longer apply because of the increase in population. I think also you got to look at Lincoln and what he did with the states and just the fact that he increased the power of the federal government by subjecting the separation of particular states from the union. His inference on union being of necessity, his interpretation of the values of the Declaration and the Constitution as being first and foremost preservation of the union, and he and his presidential exercise of power kind of influenced the way that the nation operated as a whole moving forward. So in order to respond to the Civil War, he had to be fairly heavy-handed. And if you look at some of the activities that Lincoln engaged in, if they don't break the law, they go right up on the bounds of the law as far as presidential power. But he did it for the preservation of the Union, and it seems as though we've inherited a lot of that. The thing that matters is the preservation of the Union from Lincoln. He, of course, borrows it from the Framers and the Federalists and their inference on union being for the preservation of security and the rights of the people. But I would say probably Lincoln Ford, you begin to see much more of a shift and a focus on national unity. So maybe not national government, but definitely national unity. You also are going to see a reemergence of that kind of thought a la FDR. And some of his provisions, both world wars contributed to it because it wasn't Virginia that was going into the world war, it was America. So there's multiple factors. Increase in financial dominance on the world stage. So it's much more fun to be an American when you're rich and successful, whereas right now you see more grumbling about the federal government needs to leave us alone because we're not rich and successful. So even recognizing the role that our value of probably, well, we still are rich and successful, that was an overstatement, but the sense that, oh, okay, that's in question, so we're going to revert to pushing forward state rights. And honestly, our system swings. Right? It's a pendulum. Like, one day we're all about national government, one day we're all about state government. Perhaps some of the inconsistency comes from the lack of civic participation. Anything else? Is that sufficient? All right, last one, Mr. Bostick.
Okay, this is basically an add-on to his question, but I heard this book in a lot of books that pre-Civil War, Americans said that the United States of America are, and post-Civil War, the United States of America is. And it seems to me like you'd be saying that you'd agree with that, it's that the Federalists always said that the United States is, and the Anti-Federalists said the United States are. That was just that after post-Civil War, there's more Federalists than Anti-Federalists.
No, I think that's consistent. I don't think that's actually inconsistent. Yeah. It's just even a transformation in an understanding of what federalism is. So I think that actually would be consistent. But yeah, this idea of is are. Mm-hmm. No, Mr. Bostick was the last. What's wrong with you? No, yeah. Fine comment.
Mm-hmm.
Couple of things. propaganda is often thrown around as though it's a bad thing. Anytime you have an opinion about something and you're attempting to present your ideas about it, you're going to be propagandist. You have a particular opinion. You don't want people to think about the other opinion in a good way. So you're going to present your opinion in the best way possible. I think when we use the word propaganda, we think the alternative is somehow an objective exploration of something. But we're human beings. We don't think of anything in that way. So I can't speak to you objectively about this topic because I have an opinion about it. And so I might be propagandist in the way that I talk about the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, but it's inherent to the way in which we as human beings align ourselves with positions. So are they propagandists? Sure. They're for a strong national government, and they're trying to convince people to be that way. Do I think you can still approach a text respectfully? Sure. Right? We can approach this text with an understanding that their goal is to convince people to ratify the new Constitution. Their goal is not to paint the Anti-Federalists in a good light. The inverse is true. The various authors who write the Anti-Federalist thoughts, their goal is not to present the Federalists in a good light. That's true of any discussion, right? The goal of an apologetics debate, for example, the goal of the apologetics person who's presenting Christianity is not to give credence to the arguments of the atheist. It's to make the atheist look like an idiot, just like the atheist is trying to make the Christian look like an idiot. I think what's required when we approach any text that you read in Tori, so I think this is a really good point, is the reasonableness of a learner to realize that what you're getting is an opinion, and not everything about this opinion is true, and it's your job as a reader to be discerning in your engagement of it. So insofar as they are presenting a particular position, sure, they're propagandists. Does that mean that we discredit them? No. All right? Go home. If you want some resources for learning more about the Anti-Federalists that goes beyond simply Googling it or looking it up on Wikipedia, this text here is The Essential Anti-Federalist. It's edited by Allen and Lloyd. It actually has a lot of errors, which is annoying, but it is a good compilation of core ideas. Cecilia Kenyon also published Anti-Federalist Thought. And there's a book called Men of Little Faith, which is a compilation of her thoughts. That's interesting. And there's lots of articles. And you don't really care, so have a good evening. Peace.